Who Really Killed Kennedy? That's the title of the book by Dr. Jerome Corsi. And we'll be back with Jerry in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Dr. Jerome Corsi with us. And Jerry, even though you were with me a month ago as we talked about who really killed Kennedy, I could not have a Kennedy special here without your feedback and having you part of the show. So welcome, my friend.
Thank you, George. I really appreciate it. And I really enjoyed doing the Beyond Belief videos. I think there was a great experience in Denver, and I'm getting great feedback from people who are watching them.
Yeah, me too. Me too. As a matter of fact, some of the producers there said it was some of the best television they've ever seen. So you did a great job for
us. Thank you.
Lots to talk with you about. We'll take some calls a little bit later on this hour, Jerry. And of course, with every guest, we have a different thought, a different theory. But the one common denominator is Oswald did not act alone, if he acted at all. And where do you fit in there?
Oh, identically, the same. Oswald, I don't think, fired a shot. I think he was in the lunchroom, as he said he was, where he was discovered. There's no evidence Oswald was on the sixth floor. Even the one witness that said he identified Oswald could not identify Oswald in the lineup. But I think, George, you know, some of the points I want to kind of dig in with, I begin the book by making it absolutely clear that the physical evidence, you know, when you take a look at a Parkland hospital, the doctors, and Kennedy came directly to Parkland Hospital within 10 minutes of the shooting. He was there. Parkland Hospital is a world-class hospital. And in the emergency room, it wasn't just interns. The call had gone on out in the hospital for any surgeons. There were up to 20 doctors that looked at Oswald. And immediately after Oswald died, a press conference was held. Dr. Perry at Parkland told the press that the wounds were front entry wounds, that Oswald had been shot from the front. A neck wound was a
Kennedy.
That Kennedy was shot from the front. The neck wound was a puncture wound. It was about the diameter of a number two pencil. And the back of Kennedy's head at Parkland, the doctors observed the back of the head gone, blown out. In fact, in a gruesome fashion, John Kennedy's brain was coming out through the back of the head. Yeah, and the doctors graphically described this at Parkland Hospital. A front shot, a shot from the front, meant there had to be two shooters because the limousine was behind, you know, the Tech School Book Depository was behind the limousine on Elm Street when the shooting started. So any shots from the Texas School Book Depository would have had to have entered the back, not the front, of Jack Kennedy. And the doctors at Parkland had no reason to lie. They're telling you what they saw. There's no theory at this point as to who the shooter was. The doctors who were experienced with gunshot wounds, who were experienced with emergency room procedures, universally at Parkland said that Jack Kennedy was shot from the front. And I think that's very credible testimony.
Now, let's look at this for a moment. And let me ask you this. I have seen on the internet pictures of what reportedly happens to be President Kennedy lying on a gurney, his brain splattered. Are those real pictures, Jerry? Are those the authentic pictures?
It's very hard to determine, George, because the testimony at Parkland Hospital immediately after the shooting is that the shots came from the front. Yet there's strong evidence, and repeatedly strong evidence, that what pictures are in the autopsy records at the archives in Washington have been altered. Because, again, the back entry wounds, which are what is predominantly seen in those autopsy pictures, do not correspond with what the doctors at Parkland described.
Right.
And there are a number of very credible, you know, Cyril Recht is one of the pathologists who has been strongest on this point, of saying that there were altered photos in the autopsy. The autopsy at Bethesda was one of the worst autopsies. The two Navy doctors who did the autopsy had never done a gunshot autopsy in their lives. And one of the best forensic pathologists in America was at Parkland, but the Secret Service removed Jack Kennedy's body at gunpoint and refused to allow the autopsy to be done in Dallas, even though the crime was under Dallas jurisdiction. There was no federal law making it a crime to kill the president in 1963.
Donald, you're right about that. You're
right.
Absolutely right. They never anticipated this.
Well, and George, you know, once you begin with the fact that the medical evidence, you know, varies, and I point this out, very few people realize that you've got two different, you know, like descriptions of the wounds, and Parkland, I'm taking, is the more credible because these are qualified doctors, and I'm taking what they initially said as the most credible, not after the Warren Commission had a chance to badger some of the doctors, but the initial testimony was very credible that the wounds in Jack Kennedy's body were all front entrance. The second point I really want to make, and I think this is shocking to most people, but people don't realize there are 5 million pages of documents now in the archives that were not available from the government. In 1963, these documents weren't available. Also, commission hearings. It's not just the Warren Commission. We've had subsequently, the Church Committee investigated the CIA doing assassinations with the mob around the world back to 1950. You've had the Senate Committee, the Rockefeller Committee, the Senate Select Committee, and the House Special Committee, Select Committee on Assassinations, which in the 70s contradicted the Warren Commission and said that there's a 95% chance of a second shooter. Now, one of the documents that surfaced, I think, is critical, and this was written by Lee Rankin, who was the chief counsel in January 1964 to the commission. And Lee Rankin says, we've got a real problem. There's evidence here that Oswald was an FBI agent. We have his FBI number, and in fact, we can prove that Oswald was getting a monthly stipend from the FBI for information. And to make matters worse, the FBI in Dallas admits to destroying part of Oswald's FBI file after the assassination. And then Lee Rankin says, well, that's not all. We've got another problem, and that there's also a CIA file on Oswald that began in the 1960, and this file was maintained by James Angleton. Angleton was tracking military who were loyal to the United States, who defected to the Soviet Union, pretending they were communists in order to penetrate the KGB. And evidently, Oswald fit into this group. Now, when this information came to the full Warren Commission in a meeting in January 27, 1964, and the transcript of the meeting is in the documents in the archives in Washington, Alan Dulles, one of the members of the committee, Alan Dulles of the CIA, the former head of the CIA, who was fired by Jack Kennedy after the Bay of Pigs and was put on the Warren Commission by Lyndon Johnson, Alan Dulles in the minute says, well, we can't let the American people know that Lee Harvey Oswald might have been an FBI or a CIA agent. This would be too detrimental to the agencies. We've got to hide this information. And the Warren Commission comes forward and lies and says that Oswald had no identification with or no relationship to the FBI or the CIA. And the chief counsel, Lee Rankin, knew that that was not true.
Tell me, did you investigate this Oswald in Mexico City, who surely does not look like the Oswald we knew from Dallas?
I did very thoroughly, and you know, Oswald denied going to Mexico City on that trip when he was being interrogated, and I think that there's excellent evidence, increasingly so. In fact, it was part of the House Select Committee investigations that they could not prove that Oswald took the trip. Now, they could prove that someone using Oswald's identity showed up, you know, at the Cuban embassy and the Soviet embassy, trying to make it look like they wanted to get entry back into Cuba. And maybe there, you know, also evidence that there was a payment to Oswald, that whoever was showed up in Mexico City to do the assassination from the Cuban embassy. But the photographs that were produced by the government to identify that this was Oswald photographed have no resemblance to Oswald at all, that man in those photographs. And the FBI and the CIA have never been able to produce a single photograph or any other proof identifying that Oswald was actually in Mexico City. The identity using a second identity or someone using the Oswald identity is one of the cases, one of the issues that shows up repeatedly in the evidence in both Dallas and New Orleans. It appears Let's go with the proposition that Oswald was a CIA agent.
Okay.
He was acting like a communist rather than being a communist, and the CIA and FBI felt free to use his identity behind his back to perhaps create this cover story where he was made into a patsy. And the reason I advanced this, George, is because the CIA developed this whole modus operandi of a coup d'etat of a head of state and creating a patsy who was killed immediately. This model was created in Guatemala in the 1950s, in which a head of state was killed by the CIA. They said a palace guard killed the head of state, and then the palace guard killed himself. Nobody saw the palace guard kill the head of state. And yet Eisenhower, President Eisenhower, with E. Howard Hunt, one of the CIA operatives who organized this Guatemala assassination, E. Howard Hunt of Bay of Pigs fame and of Watergate fame, and Edward Bernays, who was the chief public relations counsel for the banana company, United Fruit Company.
He basically invented public relations.
He invented public relations, and he was the counsel for the banana company. I knew Edward Bernays. My father, labor union negotiator and public relations director, hired Edward Bernays. We talked about this at length, and what the CIA, counseled by Edward Bernays, knew was, you know, the legerdemain, the sleight of hand you could do with propaganda. And I hear Eisenhower, Edward Bernays, and E. Howard Hunt are celebrating the coup d'etat they pulled off in Guatemala that nobody caught them on because the patsy, the palace guard, was dead. There was no trial. None of the evidence could ever be tested by a lawyer, and they were trying the case in the newspaper. Once the FBI had that model, or I'm sorry, once the CIA had that model, a coup d'etat with a patsy doing the killing, and then the patsy killed, that model was used over and over again in CIA mob assassinations, beginning in the Eisenhower administration and documented by the Church Committee to have continued for decades.
So with your book, Who Really Killed Kennedy, what was for you, Jerry, the most stunning new evidence that you were able to uncover?
Well, the most stunning new evidence was the really getting deeply into the fact that there had been two attempts to assassinate Jack Kennedy in November 1963, one in Chicago, one in Tampa.
Mm-hmm.
With each of these two assassinations set up in the same modus operandi, this evidence was first produced by Waldron and Tom Hartman in a couple of the books they wrote, including Legacy of Secrecy. But I went back to the archives and began looking up the original documentation. And in each one of these cases, the patsy in Chicago, beginning of November 63, and in Tampa, middle of November 63, was equipped with, had a rifle with a scope, was in a tall building on the motorcade route, and another group of assassins were in town who were going to do the real shooting. And this is the same modus operandi that was used with Oswald. And in both of the other cases, the patsies, one of whom got to be quite well known, a guy named Valet, and was interviewed even by Jim Douglas when he wrote his outstanding book, about Jack Kennedy and the event being unspeakable. Jim Douglas' book is outstanding. He interviewed Valet, and it's clear the Valet, just like Lee Harvey Oswald, was totally in the dark about all the moves that the CIA had taken to frame him and to make him look like he was going to be the assassin. And the same with Lee Harvey Oswald. If you begin to view Oswald not as a communist loner, but as a very successful trained double agent, Marine who had managed to learn Russian, had high intelligence assignments, even in Japan, was recruited by the CIA, had penetrated the KGB, was returned to the United States, and was now penetrating communist organizations supporting Cuba and providing very valuable information to the FBI in Dallas and probably in Washington, while having a CIA number and file, and being tracked by the CIA. It's a very different picture of Oswald, And he could begin seeing Oswald's actions as if he had been framed intentionally, just like the Patsy had been framed in the Guatemala incident.
Now, how long, and I was asking my previous guest, how long he thought this plot was being prepared. He thought it happened right after the Bay of Pigs.
Well, I think the pieces started moving after the Bay of Pigs. When Alan Dulles was fired by Jack Kennedy, head of the CIA, because he had lied to Jack Kennedy, tried to trick Jack Kennedy into launching a naval attack from a carrier offshore of Cuba in order to save this CIA mercenary army, not freedom fighters, but CIA-trained army at the Bay of Pigs. And Kennedy said no. He wasn't going to fall for a CIA trick and go to war with Cuba to save a lying CIA army. That firing of Dulles, who was, you know, considered a legend at the time, and by the way, in that firing, Kennedy fired all of the CIA planners in the Bay of Pigs, which included the brother of the mayor of Dallas in November 1963.
And Dulles ended up, by the way, being one of the commissioners on the Warren Commission.
Picked by LBJ, and I believe his major assignment was what, you know, was identified by Nicholas Katzenbach in a memo, who is assistant attorney general, a memo written to LBJ's press secretary right after the assassination, saying, we've got to make sure this commission establishes that Lee Harvey Oswald was the guilty party and tells that to the American people, because we want to close this case. And I think Alan Dulles' major role in the Warren Commission, and certainly the internal documents of the Warren Commission now available, substantiate this, was to prevent any investigation that the committee, Warren Commission, might undertake from implicating in the crime of the murder of the president, the CIA or any CIA activity. And there was ample evidence. CIA's fingerprints were all over this case. But, you know, thanks to Alan Dulles, none of that evidence, including the fact that Oswald may have been a CIA agent, was allowed to be presented to the committee or entered into the final report.
Jerry, it's truly a remarkable story. Will we, other than, of course, the work of fine people like you, will we ever get an official explanation? I think not.
I think, George, actually, I think we're getting closer. I mean, I think there's some outstanding work being done today. I mean, James DiEugenio is one I point out. He just did a book on reclaiming Parkland, you know, repudiating as Tom Hanks and Victor and Vincent Buglioso, whose, you know, major, massive tome is just a polemic. It's not a very effective research tool. There's outstanding research being done on every aspect of this case, showing how Oswald was framed. You know, the Mannlicher-Carcano rifle, the initial weapon found in the sixth floor Texas School Book Depository was a Mauser. It had Mauser stamped right on it, on the trigger mechanism. One of the police who found that Mauser had owned a sporting goods store. The Mauser disappeared after a wallet from Oswald was dropped at the site of the Tippit murder, the policeman who was killed in Oak Cliff.
Huh.
And by the way, there were three wallets from Oswald that show up in this. Now, very few people have three wallets.
Well, and isn't it convenient to drop it at the scene of the crime?
Exactly.
Like the World Trade Center and one of the hijackers.
Precisely. I mean, here's the evidence. And that wallet had the A. Heidel identification in it, the alias that Oswald was supposed to have bought this rifle in, the mail order rifle. The FBI finds the mail order rifle, Mannlicher-Carcano. Now, suddenly the Mauser drops out of the case. We never hear about it again, even though Walter Cronkite goes on National TV, says the Dallas police said the rifle was that killed Kennedy was a Mauser. Now, when you look at this mail order rifle, there's no proof that Oswald actually picked it up. And by the way, it was a different Mannlicher-Carcano model, 36-inch, the one that was found in the Texas School Book Depository. It was a 40-inch Mauser.
We're going to be back with more and some phone calls next. Well, those of you who have been on hold for some time, we're going to get to you first when we come right back with Jerome Corsi, as we talk about who really killed Kennedy. Welcome back, Jerry Corsi with us. And, of course, we'll continue chatting with him about his research. But let's go to some of the calls. Jim, truck driving in North Carolina. When we started, that's where he was. He's probably in Michigan by now. Hey, Jimmy, go ahead. Still with us?
Yes, I am. Good morning, George. Morning, Dr. Corsi.
Good morning.
I was watching one of the shows, one of the many they've had on this week, and they had a theory on there that I had never really heard. They had a reporter and a few people that were standing close to the car. The reporter had taken a picture of one of the agents in the second car that was standing up with an assault-type rifle. And some people had smelled like powder, gunpowder. And what his theory was that as the second car started to speed off, this agent could have fell back and the weapon went off. And that one, you know, could have been the death shot for Kennedy. I just want your comment on that. And I'll take it off the line.
Okay, great. Thanks, Jim. Go ahead, Jerry.
That came from a book called Mortal Error. I believe the agent's name was Hickey. When the book was originally issued, Hickey sued the author, and the book had to be withdrawn. The photographs show that there was an AR-15 in the backup Secret Service car, but it was on safety, and the agent is seen in the pictures holding that weapon at ready. And at ready, the safety would have still been on. The agents in the car would have known and reported if there had been an accidental shooting. It's a very, very far-fetched story. And now that Hickey is dead, the book has been reissued because defamation dies with the person. I consider it not to be a very credible theory.
What about the man with the umbrella? What about that story?
Very suspicious still, and not yet fully explained, even though the House Assassinations Committee produced a person who said they were the umbrella man. The holding of that umbrella up right at the point where the shooting occurred, at the time of the shooting, and the companion there next to the umbrella man who appears to have had a radio transmitter in his pocket. Again, I think that continues to bear more investigation. Those two people also stand up, don't seem to be running with the crowd, very calmly walk away from the crowd. They could easily have been part of an assassination team coordinating the shooting.
Next up, we go to Frank in Pleasant Hill, Iowa. First-time caller. Frank, thank you. Go ahead.
Thanks so much, George. It's been a lifetime. I finally got on, and it's nice meeting you, Dr. Casey.
Pleasure. Thank you.
I was a Marine, by the way, and I was in the Cuban Missile Crisis. That was quite an experience, that
right,
flotilla.
That
but I want to talk briefly. I always believe that the shooter, Oswald, was not him. And I talked to friends of mine, and they said they believe whatever department of the government decided to get rid of Kennedy, they hired the mob to do it because it was professionally done. Just curious what you think of that. And there were more than one shot. And my friend said they thought maybe a shot came from the sewer. Would that be possible since you said there was a neck wound? And was the grassy mall in front of the Kennedy's limo when they could have maybe shot from the front? That's just...
Well, okay, first of all... I think you're exactly right about it being a government agency. The agency would have been the CIA. The CIA had been working with the mob since the 1950s, since the Eisenhower administration, in assassination plots with the mob recruited by the CIA. It started with a meeting in the Eisenhower administration approaching Johnny Rosselli in a meeting in a New York hotel through a gentleman named Mayhew, who was an aide for Howard Hughes, who was a top CIA agent himself. At any rate, the mob and the CIA worked together on black ops assassinations, and it would have been an easy combination, and both had motive in terms of killing Kennedy. Where the shots came from, yes, the logical shot from the sixth floor window would have been when Kennedy's limousine was coming down Houston Street and making the hairpin turn right below the window onto Elm Street. Instead of waiting until the Kennedy limousine is down Elm Street, which, by the way, declines at a 3-degree angle to the triple underpass and there's an S-curve, and Kennedy's emerging from behind a tree, and all you can see is his shoulders and the back of his head. I mean, this is not an arcade game. You're not going to get more points for difficulty a shot. But yet at that point, once the car has made the turn, Kennedy's limousine now is in a kill zone. It has to go through the triple underpass, and there are several vantage points from which there are excellent shots. The by the grassy knoll closer to the triple underpass, at a distance back from behind the grassy knoll, where I believe one of the shots was taken, and you cannot rule out the sewer. It is still being examined. But I think the caller, the former Marine, understands that this was a sharpshooting, you know, feat that would have been very unlikely that one person, including Oswald, with a Mannlicher Carcano rifle, bolt action, a very inadequate weapon, could have really pulled off. It really stretches credibility to think that Oswald made that shot.
Jerry, I got an email from someone who said that her father was an executive with the Ford Motor Company in Dearborn, Michigan,
right,
where my father was.
Yes.
And apparently the presidential limo went back there afterwards. Is that true? Because this is what she said. She said her father said to her, that car had more bullets in it than you can imagine.
Well, and that's been that's the continuous report. The chain of evidence of that limousine has not been established, including the fact that the Secret Service is seen washing the limousine down with a bucket of water, cleaning up the blood and the like, at Parkland Hospital immediately after the shooting, which is
it's a crime scene.
It's a crime scene, and here they're destroying a crime scene. And I think the limousine did go for refurbishing back to Ford and Dearborn. There's no, again, chain of evidence showing that the windshield that is in the archives is the one that was in the car the day of the shooting. And the witnesses said that the fracture marks in the windshield were a bullet hole. You could put a pencil through it. Again, that same frontal shot. There was damage in the chrome. There was bullet fragments all over the car. And I think that, you know, the destroying of the limousine as a crime scene is very suspicious if you do have, as I'm maintaining, a CIA government coup d'etat. You want to make sure the evidence in that limousine is not able to be really accurately evaluated.
They did a pretty darn good job covering their tracks, didn't they?
Pretty good. But, you know, George, I think most of the evidence would be very hard to introduce into a court of law. As I said, you know, this rifle that was supposedly Mannlicher Carcano dropped to Oswald in this mail drop, there's no form, as the federal postal law required at the time, to allow a package to be delivered to a name other than the name of the person in whom's name the box was opened. There's no form showing Oswald picked up this rifle. It could easily have been ordered in Oswald's name without his knowledge. The magic bullet was picked up on a gurney in Parkland Hospital by an orderly named Tomlinson. And Tomlinson even argued to the Warren Committee in his testimony that there is no evidence that Lyndon Johnson or Jack Kennedy were ever on that gurney. Where that bullet came from is chain of evidence. A good attorney could have kept it out of court. I think Oswald could have beaten all this evidence. It was very convenient Oswald was dead, so this evidence could be made into kind of a myth, and Oswald could be prosecuted in the press.
Let's go to Douglas in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Douglas, thank you for holding so long. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you, George and Dr. Corsi. I wanted to ask you if you have ever considered that since JFK was wearing a back brace that day, that he was actually measured for that shot. In other words, he was sitting too high for the perfect headshot, so it went through his neck on the very first shot. In other words, if he hadn't had that back brace on, it would have been the perfect headshot, the very first shot.
Well, this is a very good point. I mean, I do discuss in my book, Who Really Killed Kennedy, the back brace. And I think the shooting was calculated knowing the back brace was there. The initial shots may even been to set Kennedy up. You know, the shot in the back at the autopsy at Bethesda, Dr. Hume put his finger in, and it only went about two joints. It did not go through the body. Another problem with the single bullet, there was no proof at the Bethesda autopsy that any bullet went through Kennedy's body. And by the way, the ballistics that would do a shot that would not penetrate very far into a body, more like a 22 shot, are very different ballistics than the bullets that blew Jack Kennedy's head apart, which look a lot more like exploder bullets, hollow tip, maybe mercury filled. If there's different ballistics, you know, then there's two shooters, because no shooter in the limited 5.8 to 7 seconds the shooting occurred is going to change weapons.
Next up, we go to Long Beach, California. John has been waiting. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. You stole my, Jerry, you stole my thunder, because I was going to call and say, I always wondered why Oswald, when he went right in front of him 50 feet or 60 feet away, why he didn't shoot him there if his main purpose was to kill Kennedy.
Right.
Why he didn't shoot him there? Why wait him go way down the road? It sounded to me like they wanted triangulation, but not one, this hasn't been brought up. There were actually four bullets, right? One of the four shots, one of them was recorded on the policeman's radio mistakenly, and that's why they had to come up with the magic bullet, right? And
what, well, that's, you know, the audio tape came later. That was in the 70s, and it came to the House committee, but it validated that there was shooting from the grassy knoll.
Yeah.
That tape got disputed, but I still think that it was valid. You're talking about the fourth shot that was indicated with Jim Tague, who was the witness, who was hit in the cheek by a fragment.
Yeah.
He was over by a fragment of cement from the curb where it was nicked by a bullet. He was standing over by the triple underpass. And you're right, the FBI and the commission were going to conclude, the first FBI reports that the first shot hit Kennedy, the second shot hit Connolly, the third shot blew Kennedy's head apart. And then when Tague came forward, and Tague demanded the committee was not going to investigate, you take his testimony. Tague went public with the newspapers. April 64, the committee takes Tague's testimony. Now they've got a shot that missed. So they reconstruct the whole thing and make up this magic bullet to account for the shot that missed. It's all nonsense. John Connolly always said till the day he died he was hit by a separate shot. His wife said the same thing. And that was what the FBI investigation produced. I believe it's pretty clear in the Zapruder film that the shots initially hitting Kennedy are not the shots that initially hit John Connolly.
Jerry, he was warned not to go to Dallas. He was warned repeatedly about the bubble top on the limo. Why did he go through with it?
Well, in fact, the day Jack Kennedy died, he was talking about the possibility of killing him from a tall building with a high-powered rifle with a scope. Jack Kennedy had and there were two prior attempts that month to kill Jack Kennedy. Kennedy had a kind of a fatalism to him. And, you know, those trying to protect Kennedy, knowing these assassination attempts were around, believed that he was safe that day in Dallas because it had been raining in the morning and the bubble top would have gone on the limousine. Even though the bubble top was not bulletproof, it probably would have caused the shooters to stand down because it may have deflected the angle of a bullet as it hit through the plexiglass. At any rate, the rain stopped as the airplane, the short flight from Fort Worth to Dallas, and the Secret Service, I'm sorry, the various people from the presidential party took the bubble top off the limo because Kennedy had given an order he would not, in 1963, the politics of the day, he wouldn't appear to be a coward. If the weather was good, he was going to ride open air, no bubble top. And Kennedy was a fatalist. His favorite poem was this, "I have a rendezvous with death." Kennedy was warned he was going to be killed. In the book, I show even some of the mob figures. The Elkins family warned Kennedy. Kennedy knew that the assassination plots were there, but he knew he also had to run for president again in 64, and he couldn't run for president if he appeared to be afraid to be out in public. That would not work in the era of politics of 1963.
Let's go to Mark in Oregon. Mark, you're on with Jerry Corsi. Go ahead.
Hey, good evening, George and Jerry. And, you know, thank both of y'all for, you know, the tremendous amount of effort through the years that you put into the cause of truth. Speaks a lot for you. Jerry, you were just speaking of evidence which would be admissible into a court of law, which you know, the unsaid part of that, I guess, would be in a continuum toward actually pointing the evidence at certain individuals to bring about convictions.
Right.
You have James Files, I believe his first name is James, last name right. Files, made the headshot, he claims, if I remember correctly. He was talking out of prison. He was in prison speaking about that. He probably had a load of evidence he could go into court about, tracing the chain of evidence back upward to the actual person that gave the order and everyone that was involved in between. And you also have another damning piece of evidence in James Grudy. Tom Danheiser, your producer, George, said that he is still alive, Tom thought, and that he'd been on your show, and I believe he was on Alex Jones's show 3 or 4 years ago.
About 7 years ago he was.
Right.
And you have James Grudy as a funeral director that received Lee Harvey Oswald's body, and he said publicly, he's let it be known publicly that the FBI agents came, and I don't know how many of them, I think he said two or three, and that they basically had their way to go right, made their way through there and went right in with the body and took fingerprints from the body of Oswald, mm-hmm. Transferred them to the stock of the Mannlicher Carcano right there in the yep. funeral home. This, again, is a damning evidence where you have definite suspects proven by really prima facie evidence as being involved in a conspiracy to murder the President of the United States. And from there, the chain of evidence could be traced upward as you get, you know, their testimony and assuming they would give it. But I just thought that was a thought as far as admissible evidence, Jerry, and I was wondering what you thought about it.
You're making excellent points. I want to give a shout out here to former FBI agent Zach Shelton, who I've worked with. Has done outstanding work. Zach has been fearless. Zach was one of the key people in finding files. This James Files was a criminal in prison in Illinois who confessed to being one of the shooters. What makes Files' testimony so credible and has to be examined is it's so much corroborating material. Zach Shelton spent years on this, and I'll just mention a couple of the points. When Shelton talks about being there with Nicoletti, who was also a well-known assassin from Chicago and the Chicago mobs, there's just too many details that Shelton points out Files knew, and there's too much evidence. Even these three tramps, Shelton's done outstanding yeah. work that Chauncey Holt is one of the three tramps, and Holt was a mob expert on producing and falsifying documents, and Chauncey Holt claims that his role was in part to deliver these fake Secret Service papers that were being shown on the grassy knoll to kind of back off the public when there were no Secret Service agents on the grassy knoll. So,
Jerry, I want to thank you again, though, for incredible research. Jerry Corsi, his work, Who Really Killed Kennedy?